This is Dialogue Conspiracy, Carmel, California, March the 3rd, 1975. This is number 186 in a long series of programs pushing almost 4 years now on Dialogue Conspiracy. Some of you may have heard in the news this week about the death threats Ted Chirac received. He's a researcher, a journalist who put out the movie The Second Gun and went through many hassles. That's the story of the shooting of Robert Kennedy in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. The Second Gun was put together a year ago, shown in Boston, New York. It was taken off the market, the commercial market, and said it would never be shown again in this country. And then it was brought out again this year and was presented last week at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences in Chicago. And the film, when the film began to be shown, it was split. Chirac got information that there was oil in the film and the film was permanently damaged. But worst of all, he received death threats in Chicago that the next time he opened up the film, which is scheduled for March the 12th in Washington, D.C., that he would be killed. He was told, next time it won't be your film, next time it will be you. The film is to be shown in Washington, as I say, to public officials. And this death threat, this anonymous death threat that was sent to Chirac is ominous, considering how many people affiliated with the investigation of the Robert Kennedy assassination have been murdered in the last 5 years. So I imagine, knowing the courage of Ted Chirac, he will press this movie and go ahead and get a new copy and show it in Washington, D.C., and I hope he has the proper protection and that his life is safe and that he won't be in danger, and that the American public can begin to see how the investigation took place on the Robert Kennedy assassination and see the ballistic evidence that there were two guns in the Ambassador Hotel. It was only last week that the California Supreme Court turned down the appeal of Sirhan Sirhan for a new case. Not one of the justices had a comment. Each one said no comment. So they couldn't possibly have examined all the evidence in this conspiracy, and I think it's outrageous that they keep turning down these appeals. James Earl Ray lost his appeal this last week for a new trial. He says he did not kill Martin Luther King, and these things hang in limbo because the Supreme Court and the justices and the various lawyers are not using the full weight of evidence to show the massive conspiracy and the relationship between each of these murders, and it's up to public citizens such as Ted Chirac to go about educating American people as to what really happened in their country. This last week, Gerald Ford opened up a press conference with the fact that he feared the investigation of the CIA probe would open up further revelations of American assassinations done by the CIA of foreign officials. That was a very historic news account, Associated Press Service, in terms of the way researchers have been pressing the word assassination for the last 11 years, finally admitted by the President of the United States that the CIA does political assassinations. Now, Gerald Ford was put into the presidency because Richard Nixon was in charge of the Bay of Pigs operation and worked with E. Howard Hunt and knew that the Watergate would go all the way back to the Bay of Pigs, and going back to the Bay of Pigs then comes forward. It includes the Kennedy assassination. And it was very important when Richard Nixon went out of office that he had Gerald Ford from the Warren Commission appointed President of the United States to hold the fort as long as he could while the ship goes sinking away. The Watergate exposures will lead to the John Kennedy assassination, no matter how many people are appointed to hold the fort, because the evidence is coming in from various researchers like myself, converging and pressing it to the various committees, and while they're not doing anything noticeable, new leaks will be coming out for the next 10 years. David Bellin, who's the chief investigator for the Rockefeller Committee, came out this week, and I'll read you his announcement. He was an apologist for new evidence that there was a second Oswald that's appearing, another document in the archives that's been exposed, suggesting there was a second Oswald, and that's what the bulk of this show is about today. David Bellin had a press conference to counteract his talk of the CIA and the John Kennedy assassination, and he was appointed the chief investigator for the Rockefeller Committee, investigating the CIA because he was on the Warren Commission and he worked with Gerald Ford and E. Howard Hunt and Richard Nixon in the absolute concealment of the John Kennedy assassination. Today, William Coleman was approved as new Secretary of Transportation. We've talked about him before. He is another team member riding the team who was responsible, along with the others, for the concealing the conspiracy of the John Kennedy assassination. I'll read you some quotations of his. The newest team member, Mr. Burke Marshall from Yale Law School, has been appointed as the chief investigator for the Senate investigating a CIA conspiracy. Burke Marshall is the one who's kept the various researchers out of the National Archives for years. He's allowed Owen Latimer, a doctor urologist, into the archives, and not other objective forensic pathologists to see the John Kennedy autopsy information. He was at Chappaquiddick immediately assisting Ted Kennedy and helping keep the lid on Chappaquiddick. Burke Marshall is part of the cover-up team of the CIA guarding these pieces of documents. So he's the chief lawyer for the Senate investigating the CIA. It remains to be seen which member of the Warren Commission will be put on as chief lawyer or counsel for the House. The House of Representatives is going to have its own team investigate the CIA. And of course, we know Leon Jaworski of the Warren Commission was brought in by Richard Nixon and used by Gerald Ford to keep a lid on the CIA foundations in Houston and in Mexico that would lead from Dallas to Watergate, and then he ran home without touching the Rebozo money, the Hughes money, the Mexican money, and left a lot of unanswered questions, the hard questions, that would go back to Dallas. Well, the President of the United States is talking about the CIA doing political assassinations in other countries. So I suppose it won't be long before we wake up some morning and find the same public officials saying, yes, the CIA assassinates American politicians and a lot of other people, too. Last week, I didn't get a chance to talk on the article for the New York Times. It's titled, Data on Oswald Apparently Withheld from Key Warren Investigation Aides. This is a story from February 23rd in the New York Times, and Penn Jones was my guest last week, so we didn't cover this material, and I want to go into it today at length. It was incidentally not on the front page of the New York Times, anything like that. Information that there was a second Oswald in 1960 when Oswald was in the Soviet Union, and that J. Edgar Hoover knew it, the Warren Commission knew it. That doesn't make the front page. It made page 32 of the New York Times. But the important thing and it said that J. Edgar Hoover had sent a memo to the State Department as early as 1960 before he used Lee Harvey Oswald as an agent, before he would even know who Oswald was, except as a defector. In 1960, Hoover sent a memo to the State Department raising the possibility that there was an imposter using the credentials of an American defector named Lee Harvey Oswald, who at that time was in the Soviet Union. This memo from J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI, and two subsequent State Department memos related to it were not shown to all the investigators of the Warren Commission. They were shown to one member of the Warren Commission, and I'm sure that member is Alan Dulles, who is now deceased because Oswald was an agent of the CIA, and of Alan Dulles, who used to be head of the Central Intelligence Agency and was put on the Warren Commission after John Kennedy was killed. The article goes on to say the body of the man who the commission concluded had shot the president and who was shot to death by Jack Ruby 2 days later was identified by his mother and other relatives and also by fingerprints and physical features of being Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, the New York Times was quick to say that the body buried in Texas was Lee Harvey Oswald, even though there was an imposter. And after I run through the New York Times article and a few basic points in it, I want to show you at one time, and I've done it before on this show, the fact that I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald may not, in fact, be dead, and the second Oswald was buried and then cremated in Texas. I'm not so sure that the agent of the government, the one of the Soviet Union, is, in fact, dead. One of the Oswalds is dead, we know, but I'm not sure it's the one we think of as Lee Harvey Oswald, the agent of the Central Intelligence Agency. W. David Slauson, lawyer for the Warren Commission, who at the time checked out rumors about Oswald for the commission, has now asked that the John Kennedy assassination be opened up again. He says he doesn't want a debate with his old colleagues. He doesn't want a discussion with them about this matter over the table, he says that there was a discussion about Oswald when he was abroad, and he thinks it's significant that they all didn't see the J. Edgar Hoover memos of a second Oswald. He thinks that that's an important part of the cover-up, and he doesn't know where the notion of an imposter would have led us, he said. The point is we didn't know about it, and why not? And I'm going to read off to you, as time allows, about 27 examples of a second Oswald that the Warren Commission knew about and published in their 26 volumes, which are, they're in sets of libraries. I have a set in my own home. There's about 27 instances of one, two, and three Oswalds. So it's very late in the game that Slauson, W. David Slauson, says the idea of an imposter was important. He doesn't know where the notion would have led us, because while the Warren Commission was doing their work, they constantly were aware of the fact that there was a imposter or two imposters. The New York Times article says the State Department said they have no comment on a possibility of a second Oswald because they, in quotes, all former officials who might have knowledge of the Oswald file have died or have retired. Now, that is another lie that does not hold true. Walter Stessel, who's the ambassador to the Soviet Union, would know about Oswald, an agent of the CIA. He's over there now, former next-door neighbor of mine from Beverly Hills. Priscilla Johnson would know about Oswald of the CIA. Evelyn Knight, the head of the State Department, would know about it. John McVicker of the CIA is still in the State Department. Richard Snyder of the CIA. Richard Helms, now in the State Department. E. Howard Hunt from the CIA. Raymond Rocha, Commander Hewitt, and Abraham Chase. That is nine people who would know about Oswald, the agent, and a double working for the State Department, the CIA, who are, have not died and who have not retired, as such, who are familiar with what happened in the instance of the second Oswald. Mr. Angleton just retired from the CIA just a few weeks ago when all of the exposures were coming down, and Raymond Rocha, but they just recently retired, and they'd be very familiar with his memo on Oswald. It was Mr. Rocha who testified before the Warren Commission regarding Oswald in the Soviet Union. The New York Times article says the interposition of an imposter, if that happened, is a political act. This is W. David Slauson again from the Warren Commission saying we should go into this. Well, I've said all along that those 27 or 30 instances of a double of Oswald are a political act. The Mr. Wayne who impostered Sirhan was a political act. Mr. Sneed and Eric Starvo Gold and Mr. Bridgman, the three doubles for James Earl Ray are a political act. And Bernard Keaton, the double for Donald DeFries, was a political act. These doubles are set up by the Central Intelligence Agency and sent around for specific purposes in each case, and they have the identical background and characteristics of the person that they're imitating. Now, Dr. Alfred Goldberg from the Air Force wrote the chapter in called Speculations and Rumors from the Warren Report. When interviewed by the New York Times on this new memo, he said, in quotes, "I don't have any recollection of having seen the Hoover memo. I'm fairly certain I didn't." We recall the White House used the warning, "You can always use your recollection. I don't recall." The Warren Report used it over and over and again with witnesses. That's a Central Intelligence Agency way of saying, and also used by lawyers, "I don't have recollection." So if evidence comes in later, they're not held for lying. Their recall comes back. So Goldberg, who wrote the part on Speculations and Rumors of the Second Oswald, can't recall. William Coleman, again, pointed today, Secretary of Transportation, said it's been 10 years, and I don't remember one way or the other if he saw a memo on a second Oswald, someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald. Marguerite Oswald had stated to the FBI in May 1960, when Oswald was in the Soviet Union, that he had taken his birth certificate when he left home, and in 1960, J. Edgar Hoover thought there was a possibility of an imposter using Oswald's birth certificate. It was a Mr. J.G. Harris from New York, 45-year-old researcher who has worked 10 years on the Kennedy assassination, who found declassified papers in the National Archives from the State Department and found the memo of J. Edgar Hoover himself that the second Oswald did, in fact, exist. There are two books on this subject. One is called The Second Oswald by Popkind. I'll give you the references later. It's a very good book with a lot of details on the second Oswald's traveling around in the United States. And then there are other instances of second Oswald based on many other books, which I compiled today to share with you. One important piece of evidence was a Mr. George Thompson from Glendale, California. And Mr. Thompson did work very early after the Kennedy assassination. He's an engineer, a civil engineer in Glendale. And if you want to write to him, I assume he's still alive. I haven't been in contact with him for a few years. Send me a self-enclosed envelope, and I'll send you his address in Glendale, and you can write to him. He proposed the theory on his radio talks in Glendale and in Los Angeles that there were two guns in the Dallas jail, and that Oswald, he asked the question, was Oswald dead? And he also brought up the question of the burial of Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, I think that's important. Thompson was talking about that in 1965, 66, because this week, the New York Times, as of February 23rd, made a point of saying that the Oswald who was buried had fingerprints and characteristics identified. And I saw nowhere in the Warren Commission report that this was true. And I looked up the information that Mr. Thompson had done on the what he called a big concrete vault. He claimed that there was a vault that weighed 2,700 pounds, almost 1.5 tons, of reinforced concrete. And it was set down where Oswald's grave, his box, would be placed inside of it. And he asked, why is this man buried in such a substantial vault? He said he was a design engineer, and the only time a 2,700-pound vault is normally used is for a transformer or gas main under the ground. Life magazine, in their memorial issue on John Kennedy's death, a chapter page called A Killer's Laid to Rest, refers to the hastily dug grave, and it was surrounded by uniformed police and plainclothesmen. And then a coffin was taken to the grave where this 2,600-pound steel-reinforced concrete vault was already in place to receive it. And the Life magazine went on to say that vault would withstand a sledgehammer. This is a quotation of the funeral director, Paul J. Grudy. And after that, guards were placed at the grave around the clock. Well, this engineer who had designed coffins was suspicious about the vault that received this body, the weight of it, and he also was suspicious of the autopsy of Lee Harvey Oswald, which I'll briefly go into. And then in addition to this information, I have the minutes of the Warren Commission, which I have shared before, on January 21st, 1964. And I'm going to read them again because the New York Times says, oh, there may have been two Oswalds, they imply, but the Lee Harvey Oswald was buried in Texas November 1963, November 24th. He was murdered on that day and buried a few days later. The January 21st meeting of the Warren Commission, 1964, Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, said they were discussing a lot of different subjects, Lyndon Johnson's seat and his scars and so forth. Then the chairman, Earl Warren, said, we will go from item H under Roman numeral 2 to the remains of Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, that situation is that this man is buried in a cemetery, and it takes officers around the clock to watch him and watch and see that they don't come in and exhume him and do something that would further injure this country. Whatever it was that happened to Oswald, it was injure this country. So it has been suggested that to save expense, they exhume him and cremate him. His mother made some public statement about that. She doesn't care how much it costs or what it is. She doesn't consent to his cremation. Senator Russell said, do we have jurisdiction of that? It would seem to me it would be in the court down there in Texas. And Earl Warren said, the question might arise before this thing as to something on that body now. Now, I don't know what Earl Warren means unless he means before the cremation. The question might arise before this thing as to something on that body now. I don't know what it is. It might be the course of the bullet. It might be something else. But I don't think we would want that disposed of until our report is made. And Hale Boggs, Representative Boggs, said, absolutely not. And Senator Russell said, because they would make a case of it. I thought we might do this. I thought we may get a mausoleum to take the body, seal it up, unknown to anybody else, except his wife, and the mother hasn't got anything to do with this. Fogg said, I'm a little concerned about moving him. You know how funny, and history repeats itself. And he goes into the history of John Wilkes Booth and the information being declassified and how Wilkes Booth was killed. And J. McCloy said, I don't think we ought to have on the record that we're moving in this thing. We're not saying anything about it. He tells him, it's not on the record now. We're not doing this. And Representative Boggs said, I would like to move. How do you move something without doing it? The point, like, they're not supposed to be doing it. It's not on the record now, but he wants to move it. And he says, Mr. Chief Justice, if you move that body, I don't care if you move it 20 feet or more, someone is going to say that is not the body. And you're going to have somebody go down there and pull it out of the mausoleum and have x-rays made to prove it is his body. It may cost a little money to have a cop or two around, but it's worth it. And then Russell said, we'll leave it there until we complete our work. And Senator Cooper says, here's what the man says. The lot is owned by his mother. Evidently, he called down there, and she wants to protect the grave. And Mr. Rankin said, it's in Fort Worth. Senator Cooper said, it's not within our competence to handle and cremate it. And Representative Boggs says, it is our competence to tell the U.S. Department of Justice through Nicholas Katzenbach, that's the Attorney General, tell somebody down there to tell the Dallas authorities to get that going. If it was a choice between something cremation and something else, I wouldn't take cremation. And Boggs thinks cremation is out of the question. But Earl Warren says, but I think the suggestion has been made that it is most sensible, and we should try and insist on it. And he doesn't say which conclusion they came. The suggestion is made that they're going to do this, but they're not going to do it, but they'll move on it, and we don't know if there is a body down in that grave. And Mr. George Thompson of Glendale, California, did do an extensive report on the body, and he said the bullet, according to all the pictures and testimony, was fired into Oswald's left, the left side of his body, as Jack Ruby stepped forward into the crowd in the Dallas jail when Lee Harvey Oswald was being moved. Mr. Thompson turned this autopsy report over to a trained person to read autopsy reports, and this person was not told the reasons behind the request, and they made an anatomical study of the wound. And the autopsy of Oswald was stated, some of it was very indefinite location of the wounds, and she did a diagram of the way the bullets would hit the chest, the abdomen, the spleen, the liver, the injuring and penetrating of the spleen, and came to the conclusion that this strange bullet, this is the report, went to the rear, severed the metatarsal artery from the aorta, but it left a mystery as to whether the man was killed with two bullets or one bullet. He was either not shot, and the report was an error, or he was shot in a different manner than was portrayed in all the testimony and on television. The conclusion of the report was the investigative work in the murder of Oswald was ridiculously small compared to the investigative work of the president. And the conclusion of this particular person's findings was that Mr. Thompson in Glendale, that he believed that there was a gross error in the autopsy of Lee Harvey Oswald in either the directions or the amount of damage, because there was an extensive amount of damage that either they wrote in that didn't take place to a person that would require two guns, or they just wrote something in and over-dramatized the amount of wounds, and it didn't happen the way they said it did because he was still alive in the ambulance. Now, if the body was cremated, we won't know much about that, but I think in lieu of some investigative work on the autopsy of Oswald, which is not conclusive, but which should be investigated further, and the minutes of the Warren Commission meetings on the necessity as early as January 64 to cremate that body so that the nation wouldn't have to stand some other shock, and then the disclosure now that there was a second Oswald, and J. Edgar Hoover knew it, and the Warren Commission, members of the Warren Commission knew it, and they covered it up from other members of the Warren Commission who were doing their work. So I went into my research today to show you how much there was of evidence of a second Oswald that members of the Warren Commission actually were concealing all the time they were writing the Warren Report. They come out now and say, we didn't know about that memo, and the people who would know are dead or not working. And yet, Mr. Balin is working for the Rockefeller Committee. Mr. Slauson is working, is a lawyer teaching down at SC Law School. and Mr. Coleman's been head of the Department of Transportation, Mr. Goldberg of the military, who wrote that chapter, is around. And yet there's some second Oswalds that they haven't faced up to, which are available for all the researchers in the 26 volumes. The first one is the story of Oswald seen at a rifle range. He was supposed to be hitting a bullseye at the Sports Dome in Dallas, Texas. At the time that Mr. Price saw him in Dallas, Oswald, the other Oswald, was definitely in Mexico. The Warren Commission concluded that Oswald couldn't have been at the range at the time, but they didn't go into the discrepancies of how one person could declare that he's Oswald, be at the rifle range, and the other one's in Mexico. The second example was Oswald at the apartment of Mrs. Sylvia Odio. This is a woman that worked with the anti-Castrian Cuban community. Her family came over from Cuba. Her father was still living there. If I have time, I'll go into detail more, a long story about Mrs. Odio. But she was with two people at her apartment, and one of them was allegedly a William Seymour, who was described by Mr. Lauren Hall as being similar to Oswald in appearance. And J. Edgar Hoover wrote to the Warren Commission, dated September 21st, 1964, that Mr. Seymour, who was at Mrs. Odio's apartment, looked like Lee Harvey Oswald, and that we'll check into it and let you know about it. And yet the Warren report was published September 24th, 3 days later, and they were still looking into the second Oswald, a gentleman who described himself as going to kill the President of the United States, to kill Kennedy, who said the others didn't have guts, who described himself as part of the anti-Castro Cuban community, was at Mrs. Odio's apartment in Dallas, Texas, and J. Edgar Hoover at that time, knowing in 1960 there was rumors of a second Oswald, sent a letter to the commission in September 21st, 64, knowing a look-alike belonged to the anti-Castro Cuban community and that he would let them know when they went to press, as I had to say, 3 days later, and the commission disbanded immediately. So who was J. Edgar Hoover going to let know the person that was at the apartment of Mrs. Sylvia Odio? Right after that experience, she had moved down to Miami, where other anti-Castro Cubans involved in the killing of Kennedy lived. A third example of Mr. Lee Harvey Oswald was a person at a grocery store cashing a check at Mr. Hutchinson's grocery store for $189. This was just before the assassination. I can give you the volume and page number, some of this if you want. The Hutchinson testimonies in volume 26, 178, and 179. Oswald allegedly came to that store once or twice a week and bought milk and sweet rolls and cashed a check for $189. Hutchinson knew it was Lee Harvey Oswald, yet Oswald wasn't buying these kind of breakfast foods and wasn't in Irving, Texas at the time. Fourth example of a Lee Harvey Oswald was Mr. Bogart, a car salesman, who had two witnesses in the Cadillac agency, November the 9th, 1963. Oswald didn't drive a car. One of the Oswalds didn't drive a car. Yet this man came in, left the name Oswald, said he was coming into money in a few weeks and needed a car for a fast getaway. That person was depicted in the movie Executive Action, The Way It Happened in Dallas, Texas. A fifth example is a Henry Oswald, who's going to be written, there's going to be articles about Henry Oswald coming out soon in a New York magazine. Mexico, he's from Mexico, he's photographed in front of the Cuban embassy. He's much heavier than Lee Harvey Oswald, and allegedly he is supposed to be one of the gunmen in the crossfire in Texas who is passing himself off as Henry Oswald down in Mexico. Sixth example was at September 25th, 1963, the day that Lee Harvey Oswald left for Mexico. Another Oswald was in the office of the Selective Service Bureau in Austin, Texas, using the name Harvey Oswald, and he was discussing getting an honorable discharge from the service, which would be reasonable. And the other Oswald was on his way down to Mexico in September 25th, 1963. Another seventh example in the Soviet Union when Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union. This is the time when J. Edgar Hoover said he had another person impersonating him. A. Lee Harvey Oswald was busy in the New Orleans area as a shoe salesman, and later much of the conspiracy was to take place in New Orleans. Another example of Oswald, eighth example, is Alec Heidel was the alias used by Lee Harvey Oswald both in the Soviet Union and in the Fort Worth, Dallas area. The rifle was ordered under the name Alec Heidel. But while Lee Harvey Oswald was working in Dallas, Texas, and associating with Anna Mellor from the Dallas Power and Light Company, Alec Heidel from Fort Worth, who is associated with George Bowie, working with Anna Mellor, and Marina Oswald, who's living in Fort Worth, Texas. And that's as close as the two Oswalds, I think, being together at the same time, one in Fort Worth, one in Dallas. Another Oswald, ninth example, is Don Norton, a double for Lee Harvey Oswald, who is the go-between from Montreal with David Ferry, and money from Permandex Corporation down to the Bahamas and Mexico, involved with the Oswald, who sat on a bus with Albert Osborne that we've talked on radio shows before. Tenth example was a gun shop in Dallas, Texas, where Mr. Ryder received a weapon. A man left his name Oswald. He wanted a scope attached to the gun, a rifle. This was just several weeks before the assassination, days before the assassination of John Kennedy, where, in fact, the rifle that was ordered under the alias of Oswald, Alec Heidel, came from Klein's in Chicago with a scope attached to it. Somebody was using Oswald's name. 11th example of an Oswald was a photograph in front of the Trade Mart in New Orleans. And it's a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald, but surrounded around him are all kinds of lookalikes. There's three men dressed like him and look like him in front of the Trade Mart in New Orleans when he was photographed as a CIA agent handing out Marxist literature, developing his communist front that would be used after the assassination of John Kennedy. This recent photograph is in the fourth volume of Forgive My Grief by Penn Jones, Jr. There was a 12th example of an Oswald was in Irving, Texas, a barber shop. Lee Harvey Oswald came in. He was praising communists. He came in on the 8th of November with a 14-year-old boy. This Oswald was driving a car. Irving, Texas is the area where Marina Oswald, the wife of Lee Harvey Oswald, was living with Ruth Payne. And it was impossible for Oswald to have been at the barbershop at this time. Somebody was pretending to be Lee Harvey Oswald, the communist, maybe potentially homosexual with a little boy and driving a car. 13th example of Oswald, a man who looked like Oswald, written up in the Warren Report as leaving the Texas School Book Depository after John Kennedy was killed. This Oswald took a bus, then took a taxi cab to the rooming house of Mrs. Earlene Roberts, where he was living under the name Lee as an alias. But Sheriff Craig from the Dallas area said that he saw Oswald leave the book depository and go in the front of the grass into a car that honked. A white station wagon belonging to Mrs. Payne is their hostess in Irving, Texas, where Marina was living. Later the afternoon of the assassination, Captain Fritz of Homicide was in his office with Oswald when Sheriff Craig came up and confronted him and asked him about leaving, and he said yes. He said, that's the Payne's car, don't get them involved, and that was Oswald that left by the front of the depository. Now, not only is one of the Oswalds dead, but I mentioned before, I think when Penn was here, he's written in his books about these deaths. The bus driver is dead, the taxi cab driver is dead, and the woman who owned the rooming house where the one Oswald stayed is dead. So it's very hard to check out this story because the people involved are being murdered systematically. 14th example of Oswald is September 25th, 1963, when Oswald was in Mexico. A Mrs. Horace Twifford said she got a telephone call. She was in Houston, Texas, and Oswald had called her about a subscription her husband had sent to him from the Socialist Labor Party. Oswald was in Mexico, and this call was in Houston, September 25th. 15th example of an Oswald was the bus from Mexico. The roster shows an Oswald, written in a different hand than Lee Harvey Oswald's, and they don't mention why it's on the roster, but it happened after October 2nd, after Oswald's trip. There was another name of an Oswald. I don't know if this person looked like Lee Harvey Oswald or not, but his name was on this roster after he had returned from Mexico. 16th example was in Alice, Texas, a radio station KPOY on October the 4th. Oswald was back in Dallas, Texas, and somebody came into Alice, Texas and reported that Oswald and his wife and a small child visited for 25 minutes in a battered car, 1953 car. Now, Oswald didn't drive a car, but Alice, Texas is important in this conspiracy. But this was a 16th example the Warren Commission had of another Oswald. I'll run these down as long as we have time. I have 27 plus more listed here. We're up to 17, but the point is that Mr. Sanctimonious David Bellin says there's no example, no evidence to come to his attention that diminishes the veracity of the conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin and the sole assassin of President Kennedy. That is David Bellin's answer to various researchers that came out on the United Press this week. In lieu of asking to open up the Warren Commission, David Bellin said, in quotes again, there is no hard evidence that has come to my attention that in any way diminishes the veracity of the conclusion that Lee Oswald was the assassin and the sole assassin of President Kennedy. Then you have Mr. Slauson of the Warren Commission saying impersonating this Oswald was a political act. And you can see how placing these people in strategic positions could create the fictitious personality, the movements of the gunman where one leaves town and the other is caught, because you have these doubles so very many places. And also, they emulated his wife and child, and that was also, they had doubles in addition to Lee Harvey Oswald. Another Oswald that could be emulated was that October 15th interview where Lee Harvey Oswald went to the Texas School Book Depository and was employed on October the 16th, and the motorcade came in front of that building November 22nd, 1963. But on October 15th, Lee Harvey Oswald was interviewed as a cargo carrier at Love Airfield. He was hired October the 16th. He received $100 less for the job at the book depository. Now, if the motorcade was changed, was the other Oswald, was one of these second Oswalds placed strategically out at Love Airfield that he could kill President Kennedy? Because another example of Lee Harvey Oswald, I forgot to number, and this was Mr. Valley up in Chicago, who looked like Lee Harvey Oswald, who also drove a car, who was part of the plan to kill John Kennedy 3 weeks earlier in Chicago, Illinois. And he used the name Oswald, and he drove a car. And that's one more example of an assassin or part of an assassination team using the name of Oswald, but not being Oswald. The 18th example here of Oswald meeting on October the 23rd, one Oswald allegedly went to hear General Walker speak in Dallas, Texas. Two nights later, he was supposed to have gone with Michael Payne, his host from Irving, Texas, to attend a civil liberties union on October the 25th. But yet, his landlady said he didn't go out that evening. He did not leave the house the evening of that meeting, that he stayed in his room. And in addition to that, the American Civil Liberties Union received a letter on October 22nd, just a few nights late, October the 22nd, he went to this meeting, pardon me, with Michael Payne to the Civil Liberties Union. But November the 4th, he wrote to the American Civil Liberties Union and asked the national office how he could get in touch with any groups in his area. This is volume 817. Page 673. Oswald had attended the meeting 3 days earlier, the American Civil Liberties Union 3 days earlier, and another Oswald had written a letter asking where they could contact the Civil Liberties Union and get in touch with him. So if one was attending the meeting, they goofed there, and one was writing a letter asking where the Civil Liberties Union was in Dallas. While one was at the meeting, one was writing a letter, and there would be no reason to write a letter after you attended the meeting a few nights earlier. Another Oswald was at New Orleans at the Riley Coffee Company. That's how I met Jim Garrison. When he arrested Clay Shaw, I called down there and said, Riley Coffee Company is a front for a CIA operation. One Lee Harvey Oswald got a job at Riley Coffee Company, and according to the testimony of witnesses who hired him, he was given an oiling can and told to go from the top floor on down and water parts of the machinery in the coffee company. The landlady in New Orleans, who rented the home of Lee Harvey Oswald, testified under oath or with affidavit that Oswald never went out in the daytime. He was home all day, and he had visitors at the apartment at night. So one Oswald was working, and one was home sitting on the veranda. One Oswald, a 20th example, left New Orleans in September 1963 for Mexico. But another Lee Harvey Oswald cashed a check that morning when the other one had left for Mexico, which would be an impossibility. It couldn't have arrived so fast, unemployment check from Texas to New Orleans, and it was cashed when the other one split town. It couldn't have been delivered in the mail that fast. One had cashed it. 21st example I have here is a letter written from a Lee Harvey Oswald that was dated and mailed. It has a postal mark, but was delivered One month after the other Oswald was dead, it was devoid of any Oswald's writing habits, his misspellings. And it was for some communist literature, and it went to a left-wing organization in New York City, and the purpose was to smear Lee Harvey Oswald and associate him with communist causes, but this Oswald was dead. A 22nd example of Lee Harvey Oswald is a furniture store, November 6th and 7th. He was looking for parts of a gun, allegedly, and a woman with two infants came in exactly the age of Oswald's family, and then they drove off for a gum shop. And Marina Oswald says she never saw these witnesses in her life, and Lee Harvey Oswald didn't drive a car. And this is a long piece of investigative work I've done in the furniture store. The man said, I'm going to come into a lot of money. He's looking at fancy furniture. And this the other Oswald didn't drive. And Marina says she never saw these people in her life, that they weren't looking for furniture. November the 8th, this is example number 23. Oswald reportedly came to visit his wife in Irving, Texas. It's just a small area outside of Dallas. He had an apartment, a room at Mrs. Roberts, rented under the name of Lee. And he said the report said he came to visit his wife. He came home from work with a Mr. Frazier who lived across the street. That's the Warren Report account. Yet there's no evidence at all to support this. Mr. Frazier says nothing of the kind, that Oswald came home on the 8th, and Marina Oswald said that Lee didn't visit her that weekend, but the Warren Report states that he does. Mary Dowling, a waitress at Dobbs House, this is number 24 of the Oswalds, said she's a waitress, and she said that Oswald used to stop there on his way to the Texas School Book Depository for breakfast, at which time Officer Tippit, who later was to be killed following the John Kennedy assassination, Officer Tippit also ate breakfast in this particular restaurant. She claims that Tippit sat there, as was his habit, each morning and glowered over at Oswald. The FBI wasn't the least bit interested that Lee Harvey Oswald had breakfast in the same restaurant as Officer Tippit in the morning, particularly in lieu of the fact that Officer Tippit pulled up into the residential Oak Cliff section of Dallas, and Oswald allegedly put his hand on the window and talked to Officer Tippit. And shortly after that, Tippit was dead. He got outside of his car, stepped around the outside. Tippit was dead. Two men have shot Officer Tippit. This expose has not been properly published yet to show what happened there, but this was excuse to arrest Lee Harvey Oswald in a nearby theater later. But Tippit, according to Mary Dowling, ate breakfast in the same restaurant as Lee Harvey Oswald, and she never explains what he was doing over in the Oak Cliff section. After the shooting of John Kennedy, there was a J.R. Worrell, an eyewitness to the shooting that took place from the Texas School Book Depository. He heard four shots, and he saw part of a gun sticking out of a window, not the sixth floor, but another window. And he ran behind the building, and he saw a man rushing out of the back of the building around the opposite direction from that building. And he told a Dallas policeman, K.L. Anderson, that it was Oswald he saw. He recognized him on TV. That's volume 24, page 294. And that was another second Oswald. A Mr. January, who rents airplanes at the Redbird Airfield, saw an Oswald on November 20th, 1962, behind a car. He recognized the man, and two people wanted to rent a car November 22nd, take it to Mexico, and return it on Sunday, November 24th. I brought in some figures that I don't have time to read. Our time is running out. Of the height and characteristics of Lee Harvey Oswald, the other Oswalds, his Marine papers and his Soviet Union papers, he's 5'11 straight through. His Dallas Fort Worth papers, his employment, his autopsy, his job applications are 5'9". His entering the Marines when he was in high school, and his first Marine records, early ones, according to Kerry Thorley, were 5'5". His medical examination of the Marines was 5'8". But there's a big discrepancy of many examples of 5'9 in the Dallas, New Orleans area, and a 5'11 in the Soviet Union and in the Marines, which would support the J. Edgar Hoover memo that there was a second Oswald. Our time has run up, and we'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves, and we'll continue on Dialogue Conspiracy with you next week.